From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
He's given out three verdicts, three punishments of death. And I'm standing up there in shock thinking, like, how can he do that? How is it possible to die three times?
Harold Wilson, convicted of a triple murder, sentenced to die, served over 17 years in prison, most of that time on death row. He was exonerated last month based on DNA evidence.
And I walked out the back door of the county prison, 9:30 at night, onto State Road with 65 cents in a token.
Today, a Democracy Now! Exclusive, Harold Wilson, in his own words.
A part of my life has been taken away. My children, the bringing up of my children, the responsibility of a human being and a man, the decency. So being free will take some time.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 33,000 New York City transit workers have gone on strike, shutting down the country's largest public transportation system. The strike was announced around 3 this morning by Transport Workers Union President Roger Toussaint.
New Yorkers, this is a fight over whether hard work will be rewarded with a decent retirement. This is a fight over the erosion or the eventual elimination of health benefit coverage for working people in New York. It is a fight over dignity and respect on the job, a concept that is very alien to the MTA.
The city says the strike is illegal, is turning to the courts to order workers back to their jobs. Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez has been covering the story through the night.
This morning around 3 a.m., the union's executive board finally decided to move forward with the strike. It was after several hours of discussion among the union leaders because they had rejected the last offer of the MTA, which would still have required new members of the union to pay into a pension plan at an inferior pension plan, one with a higher retirement age, and despite a slight increase in the contract offer for wages, that issue of creating a two-tier pension system was the key one where the union felt it had to go on strike. However, at the last moment, the international parent union of the TWU, Michael Bryan, the president there, refused to authorize the strike, and that was part of what the delay was, as the parent union at the final moment told Roger Toussaint and Local 100 that they could not endorse or authorize a strike, that they would not actively oppose it, but that they would let the court know that they were not authorizing this strike. So there was a difficult situation for Roger Toussaint and the union leadership, because on the one hand they were battling the MTA, on the other hand their own parent union turned on them at the last moment. Nonetheless, the executive board of the union voted 25-10 with 5 abstentions to move forward and organize the first strike in a quarter century of the transit system. And it is now a battle that the whole organized labor movement will be tested because Roger Toussaint and the union insist that they are fighting not only to defend the pensions of their own members, but of thousands and thousands of other public employees who could face similar two-tier wages or pension systems in the future.
Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez. In Washington, newly released documents show counterterrorism agents at the Federal Bureau of Investigation have been monitoring domestic activist groups, including Greenpeace, Catholic Worker, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, and PETA, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. The documents indicate the FBI monitored protests organized by the groups and used confidential informants inside the organizations to gain intelligence. In one case, government records show the FBI launched a terrorism investigation of PETA in Norfolk, Virginia. According to the Washington Post, the documents offer no proof of PETA's involvement in illegal activity. But more than 100 pages of heavily censored FBI files show the agency used secret informants and tracked the group's events for years. The FBI also monitored political activities on college campuses. One FBI file included a contact list for students and peace activists who attended a 2002 conference at Stanford University aimed at ending sanctions then in place in Iraq. This is the third major recent revelation about domestic spying. Last week, NBC News revealed the Pentagon's been monitoring peaceful anti-war protesters, and the New York Times exposed how President Bush ordered the National Security Agency to eavesdrop on Americans without court-approved warrants. Ann Beeson of the ACLU said, quote, "It's clear this administration has engaged in every possible agency from the Pentagon to NSA to the FBI to engage in spying on Americans." On Monday, President Bush held a news conference and defended the National Security Agency's spying program, but criticized sources inside the government for speaking with the press.
There's a process that goes on inside the Justice Department, and I presume about leaks. I presume that process is moving forward. My personal opinion is it was a shameful act for someone to disclose this very important program in a time of war. The fact that we're discussing this program is helping the enemy.
President Bush went to great lengths to block the publication of the story. The New York Times had uncovered the secret program a year ago, but withheld publication at the request of the White House. Newsweek's now reporting Bush then personally summoned the paper's publisher, Arthur Sulzberger, and executive editor Bill Keller to the Oval Office 2 weeks ago in an attempt to talk them out of running the story. The Bush administration has repeatedly defended the secret program. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez said Congress implicitly authorized the program when it voted to allow President Bush to use force following the September 11th attacks. But legal experts say Bush broke the law by ordering the spying operation without a court-approved warrant. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Today, the memorial service for executed death row prisoner Stanley Tookie Williams will be held in Los Angeles. Last week, California Governor Schwarzenegger denied Williams' bid for clemency. Williams was executed by lethal injection. He spent 24 years on death row after being convicted of four murders. Though he was co-founder of the Crips, one of the country's most notorious street gangs, once in prison, he became a vocal advocate against gang violence, a children's author, and a Nobel Peace Prize nominee. Williams and his supporters maintained his innocence up until his death. Today, we bring you a Democracy Now! Broadcast exclusive. We spend the hour with Harold C. Wilson. He was convicted of three murders. He spent more than 17 years in prison, most of the time on death row. Last month, he was exonerated based on DNA evidence. He joined us yesterday in our firehouse studio for an extended conversation. In 1989, a Pennsylvania jury sentenced him to death three times, once for each murder. This is Harold's story.
Standing in front of the judge, being sentenced to death three times, I felt a shock from my toes to the top of my head. It took my breath away, and I went in shock. I didn't realize the sentence of death.
Death three times for three murders.
Three times for three murders. And I didn't realize I was in shock till after I went upstate to Grady Ford Penitentiary, like maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks after. But it was like something invaded my body, my spirit, when he announced the sentence of death execution at that time. It was supposed to be electrocution at that time. Would go through my body until I'm dead. I forget the actual voltage, but I'm going in shock, and I can feel the shock through my body. And he's telling me that he's giving out three verdicts, three punishments of death. And I'm standing up there in shock thinking, like, how can he do that? How is it possible to die three times by electrocution? Survival, you asked about survival on death row. It has to be physical, spiritual. And you have to keep your mind open to the real reality of life. Thinking about your loved ones and the memories of the past, you know, the holidays, which you do not generally enjoy on Pennsylvania death row.
Harold Wilson was frequently held in solitary confinement for extended periods of time. After a decade on death row, in 1999, Wilson's death sentence was overturned due to ineffective counsel. I asked him about the conditions of his detention and where he was when he learned his death sentence, though not convictions, was overturned.
I was never taken off of death row. I remained on death row even though the courts, Pennsylvania courts, Court of Common Pleas, on a post-conviction relief petition, found counsel ineffective for failing to investigate. I still remained on death row because this is the practice of Pennsylvania.
Even though they overturned your sentence?
Even though they overturned my sentence of death. I remained on death row at SCI Green amongst all the rest of the condemned inmates and prisoners.
Who told you that they had overturned the death penalty? And where were you in the prison?
I received notice in the mail from my litigating attorneys, Rob Dunningham, Mary Hansen. And
do you remember the moment?
The moment
that you learned?
Yeah. Mm-hmm, I do.
Where were you?
I believe I was in a restricted housing unit at the time.
That means you're in solitary confinement.
I'm in solitary confinement in a restricted housing unit, serving 30 days DC time for disobeying a direct order, covering my vent, protecting myself from the freezing cold temperatures, which was practice not only in SCI Green, but what we call that Abu Briggs.
Abu Ghraib?
Abu Ghraib.
Wait, what do you mean?
I mean, freezing cold temperatures, cold deprivation was used as a punishment to silence most of the condemned, if not silence most of the condemned, to put you in a sickly state where you had to totally depend on its medical department.
So in your cell, they made it extremely cold?
Extremely cold.
And you were trying to cover the vent?
I wasn't trying. I did it. And I served numerous D.C. time, numerous misconducts. I was served numerous misconducts.
What is D.C. time?
D.C. time is what they call disciplinary time.
What did the cold do to you?
It affected my bones. You know, at some points it was so cold that in my cell, the cells that I was placed in, it was so cold that I could scrape the inside window with an ink pen. I can scrape ice off the inside of the window. And a lot of times I had to sleep in my clothes. I couldn't wash up at the sink because the temperatures was unbearable.
When you say sleep in your clothes, you mean all your clothes at once?
All the clothes that was issued a condemned inmate or prisoner, death row inmate, all the clothes that was issued at that time, I had to sleep in them. I had to wear them. I had to eat with them on. I had to...
What were those clothes? How many?
At that time, you were issued two pair of pants, two shirts, and a summer jacket.
So you
were allowed to own a pair of thermals, one pair of thermals, and personal socks. I made my personal socks, the thick wool hunting socks. And you had to use those clothes to survive. There was some inmates that I remember. One, George Banks. He used to put paper bags. He was a worker. They made him an inmate worker. He used to put paper bags in his sheets in his bed. So his body warmth, when he covered up at night, his body warmth would keep him warm throughout the night until they opened up his door again to let him out. And he made paper hats. You know, you have a cloth wool hat that they give you, and Scully, or I think it's called. And they used to make a bag out of a hat, and then he put the wool hat over the bag. He used to take plastic and put on his feet, and then he put 3-4 pair of socks on. So I was the only one subjected to the freezing temperatures, freezing temperatures in the cell.
And you would be thrown in the hole in solitary if you covered
the
vent.
Yeah, because most inmates wouldn't do that. Like George Bench, he would never do a rule infraction, which is cover a vent, disobeying an order. Most inmates had pacifiers, TVs, and radios and cable, and those were one of the major tools to pacify death row inmates. The loss of their TV or the loss of their cable for 30 days was unthinkable for most. But in my case, I didn't have those shortcomings. I didn't deal with those pacifiers. I mean, what was important was why I'm here. What will it take to articulate myself to a level that my attorneys would do what was needed to be done? What was needed to be done was filed in a timely manner.
And so they never had that to take away from you. So they just would throw you in the hole.
Never. I never gave them the opportunity to dehumanize me to that point where I would second guess my safety or my life betterment for something worldly as a TV.
You mentioned Abu Ghraib, Harold. When you saw the images at Abu Ghraib, did you see them when you were in prison?
No.
Of prisoners being tortured?
No.
But you heard about it?
No, I heard about it.
How did you hear about it?
I believe that I was in the county prison at that time on what they call a writ of bring down to address some issues or at some point, yeah, I was in the county.
So this was after you were at SCI Green when you went to the county prison?
Well, I was at the county prisons numerous times just the litigating of my PCRA to get rid of the death penalty and whatever. So I spent a lot of time off and on.
Uh-huh. So in that case, SCI Green actually had a direct connection to Abu Ghraib because of a prison guard who ended up at Abu Ghraib, Charles Greener, who has been convicted of some of the torture in the unit there, in the prison, within the prison. Were you familiar with Charles Greener?
I was, I could say, familiar with Officer Greener's demeanor, his method of torture, his method of abuse, others, but he drew the line when it came to me because I was one of my investigators called me a pain in the ass to my jailers because I would file grievances. I would go attend my 30-day review when most death row inmates wouldn't.
You used the law library.
I was staying up. We had to fight for the law library on death row.
The guards had to take you there.
Yes, yes. You had to be escorted. Any movement was, when you were subjected to escort by two officers. And you were cuffed in the back. And it was the discretion of the officer whether to cuff you in the back or cuff you in the front or use shackles and leg irons. Those were left to the discretion of the officer. But, yeah.
And how did the officers treat you as you were taken to the law library to build and challenge your case?
Well, most of them... Let's put it like this. They always appointed my escorts to be the most racist.
Former death row prisoner Harold Wilson. Coming up, remarkable videotape of the prosecutor who convicted Wilson. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Stay with us.
Love just one nation. In the whole world we divide. You say you're sorry. There is no other choice. God bless the people then. Now cannot raise their voice. We can chase down all our enemies. Bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. Whoa, we may even find a solution to hunger and disease. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it.
Michael Franti performing Bomb the World last month inside Folsom State Prison. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In 1999, Harold Wilson's death sentence was overturned because of ineffective counsel. The lawyer, Willis Berry, has since become a judge. Despite having his death sentence overturned, Wilson's murder convictions were not, and he remained on death row. Harold Wilson was originally prosecuted by former Philadelphia Assistant District Attorney Jack McMahon. In 1997, the courts began examining Philadelphia's jury selection process after McMahon's role in a training tape was revealed. That year, District Attorney Lynn Abraham, who was in a tight reelection campaign with McMahon, released a training video showing McMahon instructing colleagues to keep poor blacks off juries, saying they were less likely to convict. Here's an excerpt, or here are excerpts from that video. We're going to go to that video. Jack McMahon, the former Philadelphia prosecutor. And this videotape was key in granting Harold Wilson a new trial after it found that McMahon had used racial bias to eliminate black jurors. We're going to try right now to go to that videotape of Jack McMahon.
The idea is to get a competent, fair, and impartial jury. Well, that's ridiculous. You're there to win, and in order to win, and the defense is there to win too, and the only way you're going to do your best is to get jurors that are as unfair and more likely to convict than anybody else in that room. Let's face it again. There's the blacks from low-income areas are less likely to convict. I understand it. It's an understandable proposition. There's a resentment for law enforcement. There's a resentment for authority. And as a result, you don't want those people on your jury. And it may appear as if you're being racist or whatnot, but again, you're just being realistic. You're just trying to win the case. If you're sitting down and you're going to take blacks, you want older blacks. You want older black men and women, particularly men. Older black women, on the other hand, when you have like a black defendant who's a young boy and they can identify as his, you know, motherly type thing, are a little bit more difficult. The men don't have that same kind of maternal instinct towards them, and they're a little bit more demanding and a little bit more law and order. You don't want smart people, because smart people will analyze the hell out of your case. They have a higher standard. They hold you up to a higher standard. They hold the courts up to a higher standard because they're intelligent people. They take those words reasonable doubt and they actually try to think about them. And you don't want those people. Bad luck with teachers, bad luck with social workers, bad luck with intelligent doctors are bad. I always feel doctors are bad too.
Jack McMahon, former Philadelphia prosecutor. In 2003, a trial court granted Harold Wilson a new trial after it found that McMahon had used racial bias to eliminate black jurors. Harold Wilson's second trial was a mistrial. Then on October 31, 2005, Wilson's final trial began. DNA evidence was presented for the first time. On November 15th, Harold Wilson was acquitted of all charges. I asked him to describe the moment.
What they did was they told the jurors that after three deadlocks that they had to come back with a verdict, and it must be unanimous. All 12 juries must agree. So they went back, and I was removed from the courtroom and put in a holding cell. And about 10 minutes, 15 minutes at the most, they called me back, sat me down. And they said, ladies and gentlemen of the court, the jury has a verdict. And the jury came in. And they said, jury floor person, would you please read your verdict? Have you come to a verdict? He said, yes. And I say, what is that verdict? Some of that sort.
You're standing?
Yeah. Oh, I'm standing. My two defense attorneys are standing. The district attorney's standing. And the jury floor person reads the verdict. And I believe the court crier says, on the charge of first-degree murder, and bill number, how do you find the defendant? Say you not guilty or guilty? I said not guilty. I say on the second count of first degree murder, how do you find the defendant guilty or not guilty? They said not guilty. And I never heard anything else. My attorneys just asked the court, could I be seated because I broke down? And I was seated, and next time I remember, I was being escorted out of the courtroom into a holding cell. And the verdict was not guilty. Three counts of first-degree murder. And not guilty of possession of instrument of crime. So my prayers were answered. My family's prayers, my mother's, my sister, my brother's prayers were answered.
Was your mother and sister in the courtroom?
My mother, sister, and brother. My mother and sister was in the courtroom. My brother was in the lobby.
And your mother and sister? Did you see them as the verdict was read?
At some point, at many points of the new trial, I was told and directed by the judge and the sheriffs not to be turning around in the presence of the jury. So I had to abide by those rules of the court. But I was told following after the verdict that that my mom had her hands in the air like this, hallelujah. My sister, she had her hands folded in a prostrate manner, you know what I mean, praising God. And that I had three angels on my jury, and they claimed that they pointed them out. They could see it in their face after when the verdict was being read, that who held out, that it was some students on the jury that was studying, was going to a college for a DNA, and I believe they did what was right.
Using DNA in cases. So you're brought to a holding cell. When were you released?
Well, I was brought to a holding cell and taken back to the prison on State Road. The county prison on State Road was picked. And at some time at 9 o'clock, I was escorted to the receiving room, the intake room, and process for release. I called my family, tell them that they're kicking me out. Can you believe it? After 18 years, they're kicking me out of prison. I need somebody to come pick me up. And they said, oh, no doubt, we'll be right there. And I signed the processing papers for my release. I was given a copy of my release papers. I was given 65 cents and a token. And I was told that I couldn't leave the facility with SCI Green State Correctional DOC on my clothes. So they gave me clothes to wear and a jacket. And I walked out the back door of the county prison, 9:30 at night, onto State Road with 65 cents and a token. And no other means of support or survival.
And the clothes on your back.
The clothes on my, the clothes that they gave me. And the support network of our family, my immediate family.
Did you have any kind of a suitcase or?
I had a black trash bag with the remaining items of my legal property and the things that I needed to hold on to.
And was your family there to greet you?
No, not really. My family, they were further down the highway looking for me to exit from the personnel and staff front door of the prison. And I had two, it was two cars out front. And it was Puerto Rican release along with me that day. And he asked, could they drop me somewhere? And I said, no, it's not necessary. My family come to pick me up. They said, well, Poppy, we're not going to leave you out here. You know what I mean? Until somebody come pick you up. You sure that they coming? I said, I'm positive. I called them. He said, well, would you like to call them again? I said, sure, no problem. And it's pitch dark. And they passed me a cellophone, opened it up, and it lit up like a Star Wars or a Star Trek. You know, beam me up, Scotty. I'm like, whoa. This looked like the whole State Road lit it up. I said, excuse me, you're going to have to do this. I said, I've been locked up 18 years and some. And I don't know nothing about this technology here, this cell phone. I said, you're going to have to do this for me. They said, oh, we'll do that. And I gave him the number. He called my brother, and he was right down the street making U-turns in front of the door of the prison. So grabbed my little bag, my little black trash bag, my legal stuff, jumped in the car, and he dialed my daughter in Arizona, Letitia Wilson, and we talked all the way from State Road to the family's home. When I got home, the doors was open, the lights was on, and the cameras was flashing. Mom still had her hands up in the air, praising God, thanking God for my deliverance.
You talked about your daughter. Mm-hmm. You also have a son. How old were they when you were?
My son and daughter. I had just started a family at that time. My son was 2 years old. It was my first. I helped pull him out the womb of his mother. And my daughter was 1 year old. And at that time I struggled for survival and trying to understand how to survive with a family of two. A young lady that, loved me enough to give birth, to put her life on the line, to give birth to two beautiful children. And I was struggling at the time. But they were young, too young to be raised up without a parent or father figure.
Your son went to Iraq.
Yes, my son is now a military Marine serving in the armed forces, certified tank operator for United States Marine Corps. He served in Iraq on the front line. At some point, he witnessed his best friend get blown up in a tank or rolled over some type of landmine or something like that. And since then, he's been debriefed and assigned to lighter duties in Okinawa, Japan.
How did he deal with his friend's death? He saw it happen?
He witnessed the death of his friend, and he witnessed the death of, I assume, many other soldiers. Many other innocent lost lives.
When he signed up for the Marines, did he think he was going to go to Iraq?
No. We were always, as family, we were always under the impression that he would not be thrust into the battle of, or put on the front line in Iraq.
Was he told that? That he wouldn't
we
be fighting?
We were told. What he was told, I cannot elaborate on. But we were told, as family members, it was related to me through my family that you don't have to worry about it. His father's, his stepfather is in the military, and he won't be going to Iraq. But that didn't happen. He went to Iraq, and he served, and he fought for his life, and he watched people die.
Was he able to call you in prison to tell you about what happened?
No, he was never allowed to call me personally in prison and talk to me about his active tours in the field.
How'd you hear about the killing of his best friend?
I heard about what he was dealing with through family, because he would call his family. He would call my mother. He would call my sister. He would call my parents home, and he would write letters. I still spend time right now, nights and days, reviewing those letters. And that is how I came about to know and understand what type of suffering and what type of life that he had to be born in.
How did you feel being locked up in prison as your son was in Iraq and his friends were being killed?
Knowing the Bush administration and knowing how unjust the war is being inflicted on the minds and the spirits of American citizens and the families and parents, my son's service in the United States military was worse than the 3 death penalties because it was unbearable for me. It was, I found myself praying for his safety. Hours out of days, weeks, months. It was, every time you would see something on TV or magazine, I came across it, I always thought about him. And I prayed for his safety. I prayed for his deliverance. You know, it was worse than the United States or the city of Philadelphia's threat of death or threat of 3 life sentences. You know, nothing meant more to me than my son's safety. You know, and it was at times it was unbearable. It was to the point where I went to religious chaplains and asked them. You know, I was under the banner of Islam, and I went to them and I told them, "Listen, Chapman Mack, did you gotta pray for my son? He's in Iraq, and he don't know why he's there. He was trained and he was brainwashed to believe that he was fighting for the safety and the protection of the United States people and our citizens and." His life is being sacrificed to a bunch of Muslims that were killing. And it was just painful. It was worse. It was worse than the sentence of death for me every day, knowing that his death penalty was going to be greater than mine.
Exonerated death row prisoner Harold Wilson. We'll be back with him in a minute.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means.
Nina Simone here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In this Democracy Now! exclusive, we return to our interview with exonerated death row prisoner Harold Wilson. He spent over 17 years in prison. His daughter, Letitia, is a prison guard in Arizona.
From my experience being in prison and incarcerated on Pennsylvania death row, she treats the people that she come around, the inmates that she come around with compassion and a heart of forgiveness and betterment for their release being a minimum security prison. Most of the inmates housed there are her age or younger. So she talks to me 3 times a day. Sometimes half of the night. And she has the spirit and to be a role model within the belly of the beast, but I have informed her that she wouldn't last with the heart that she came in there with, the help and the love and the assistance that she renders to the young inmates, that it's hard to live that type of life and go under the policies and enforce the rules and not be a doer of oppression.
When Stanley Tookie Williams was executed, did she describe to you what it was like in the prison?
Yes, she told me once Brother Tookie was murdered at California and New York. California and Arizona prisons were put on lockdown. And there was some violence in the street amongst gang members, the Blood and the Crips. And in Philadelphia, me and my family sat there in the living room area, and we did our best screening the news, and you saw nothing of the violence or no news briefs relating to the lockdown in prison in California or Arizona. So it was basically, we were shut off to that type of, to the activity that was going about.
What were your thoughts that night?
My thoughts dealing with
Tookie's death, his execution, you having just come out of prison and having spent so much of your life on death row.
Dealing with my present situations and the system of things and how the criminal justice system function, it was never a doubt in my mind that Tippy would be murdered, because this is the practice of the power that be. And when you choose to be a political leader in the present system that be a governor, when you run for elections, majority of them have this war cry, this rally cry, that yes, I am hard on crime and I believe in the death penalty. And for those of you voters that are for the death penalty, I will support you. So when you deal with the final phase that he was dealing with, and you're not talking about issues of innocence or issues of constitutional magnitude, violations of trial counsel, court proceedings, evidence withheld, Tippia's issue were his betterment, his fulfillment for future betterment of people in society, and the change that was reborn into his heart and his actions.
Harold C. Wilson, you were put out of prison after 18 years, most of that time on death row, with 65 cents and a token. Where does that leave you today?
That leaves me as an exonerated former death row prisoner. That leaves me to fend for myself, to to survive at a level higher than a homeless person. Because at this time, I don't know where my next meal coming from, other than the support of family. I don't have any financial income. I don't have any work. I wasn't like I was being released and placed in a halfway house. It's not like being told that you have to report to a parole officer in 72 hours or you will be rearrested. It's like, you know, after 18 years of dealing with the injustice system, all the abuse, the physical, mental abuse, I'm placed back in society with nothing. Just you know what I mean, the shelter of family. You know, no means of livelihood, no means of support. No financial bank accounts, no credit card, no compensation whatsoever. You know, it's like we did what we had to do. The jury has rendered its verdict. We have a system in the United States and Pennsylvania that the jury verdict is part of the practice of the criminal justice system. And now you do what you have to do to get your life back together.
Are you suing the state for holding you for 18 years?
I sued the district attorney, the city of Philadelphia, Jack McMahon, former district attorney who prosecuted my case, and Len Abraham.
District attorney.
District attorney, lead district attorney of the city of Philadelphia. And I filed this 1983 civil rights violation before my new trial. Once I was given relief, I had 2 years to do that. Upon the granting of the new trial, I had 2 years from that time to file civil actions. And I did that pro se on my own. At one time, I filed a motion for appointment of civil counsel. I was granted that motion for civil counsel as a poor person. And during the time of my retrial, my first mistrial, that appointment of counsel was vacated. They took the counsel away from me. And so I've been left without counsel until I think December 7th, attorney Richard Ostrich gave notice to the court and to the district attorney's office that they are representing my issues.
How are you adjusting? I mean, almost half your life you are accompanied by guards anywhere you go. You're shackled, you're cuffed. How do you even walk out on the street?
Well, I can say one thing for sure. When I use public transportation, I do get lost a lot. And I either get off two blocks past my destination or two blocks before my destination. So I'm not doing too well with SEPTA. And I walk a lot. Getting around is hard because I have medical issues. That is another thing in itself I had to deal with, because in prison you pay $2 and you get treated. It's called copay. And out here, I have medical issues, and when my 30-day supply of medication runs out, I'm stuck. I'm dealing with the suffering and the pains of arthritis, degenerated kneecaps.
What was this caused by? What was all of this caused by?
Oh, this was caused by the conditions of my confinement in the past 18 years of surviving on death row. You know, the cold temperatures, the lack of sunshine and fresh air. You know, restricted in some institutions, I was restricted to 1 hour a day outdoor recreation. And other institutions, we had to file lawsuits to get 2 hours of outdoor recreation, sunshine, and fresh air. So these factors play a great part in deteriorating your memory, your eyes, and your bones.
Harold, after 18 years, newly exonerated, in these last few minutes of the program, is there anything you would just like to share with the people who are watching and listening in this country and around the world as we move into this holiday season?
Certainly, I would hope that this story and its broadcast could open the hearts and the the hearts and the pockets of some of the listeners, that they would willfully and prayerfully try to render some kind of financial assistance, contrary to the hard and abusive manner in which I was released. You know what I mean? With nothing to compensate me, or that I can get through the holiday season, you know what I mean, just passing something nice off to my grandson, to my daughter, you know what I mean, to my mom, who had only received a card or a written piece of poetry from me for the last 18 years or so. You know, I know for a fact that she wanted a coat, and I really want to be the first to buy that coat for her. I know that my son in Iraq wanted a laptop, and it's just so many things that that at this point that I desire.
Harold C. Wilson, exonerated after more than 17 years in prison, most of that time on death row, freed last month with 65 cents and a token in his pocket. If you'd like to get in touch with him, his email address is haroldcwilson@gmail.com. That's haroldcwilson@gmail.com. His P.O. Box is Harold C. Wilson, P.O. Box 19709, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19143. That's Harold C. Wilson, P.O. Box 19709, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19143. We'll have his P.O. Box and email address on our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Fodo Caduce, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Yoruba Rich, and Maddie Harper. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.